The Spectator magazine combines incisive political analysis with books and arts reviews of unrivaled authority. Subscribe today for just £12 and receive a 12-week subscription in print and online, plus a £20 Amazon gift voucher, absolutely free. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher.
Hello and welcome to Women with Balls, where I, Katie Balls, speak to today's trailblazers. My guest today is an artist whose work, once seen, is hard to forget. Growing up on a family farm that at one point has llamas, 200 goats, and a pair of ostriches, she still works with animals today, but in a rather unconventional way. She studied English literature at university, but it was her job as a bartender at the Shoreditch Electricity Showrooms that introduced her to new artists and saw her start creating her own work in the form of taxidermy. It wasn't long before she was going to parties thrown by Damien Hirst and selling pieces to Kate Moss, and she recently won the first Plinth Award. She describes those who question her art as childish, asking, "Why anthropomorphise the animals? All you can say I'm doing at the very worst is depriving a crow of a meal." My guest today is the taxidermist Polly Morgan. So Polly, thank you for joining us today. On this podcast, we'd like to begin by asking her in the same question, which is, would you describe your childhood as a happy one?
In the main, yes, it was. It wasn't perfect, but I mean, it was great. I had two older sisters and we got on very well. We kind of fought like normal sisters do, but we're very close now. My mum and dad weren't happily married and they'd really struggled with money. But I think all of those things ended up actually being a help probably in the long term, not a hindrance. It was quite an eccentric childhood. We didn't actually have a farm, but my dad had loads of animals and he used to rent the odd field off local farmers. And he was always setting up businesses with animals involved. Somehow they were kind of integral to the business. But he wasn't a businessman. He wasn't business minded. And he was quite easily exploited by other people, I think it's fair to say. I remember one of the biggest fights my parents had. They were really screaming at each other, which they didn't do very often. They just didn't get along very well. But I asked her years later what the fight was about, and she said it was because my dad had been owed quite a significant amount of money, for them anyway, at the time. And she'd found out that he'd, instead of taking the money, he'd been paid for it with about 200 goats instead. So there was a big truck arriving with loads of goats, which just had to be fed and looked after and obviously cost money. And that was kind of his attitude. He was very sentimental towards the animals and he would never, none of them were killed. They were either bred for their fur or, yeah, the ostriches we had briefly. That was during the BSE crisis when everyone thought ostrich meat was going to, well, some people thought ostrich meat was going to become the new steak. So my dad invested in a pair of ostriches and then, which are really expensive, I think, a mating pair, but then one of them dropped dead, so that wasn't much good.
Do they have names,
the animals? No, because we didn't actually, those ostriches weren't, they weren't very local to us, but the llamas and the goats and everything did. Well, some of them did. We had our favourite ones. But it was kind of an eccentric childhood, looking back on it, because I spent a lot of time just helping out with the animals, trying to like herd goats back in off a main road. They were constantly breaking out of the field. That's one of my most enduring memories, is just being woken in the middle of the night, or it felt like the middle of the night to me at 7 years old, and I'm running around in my nightie in the middle of a main road trying to get goats back into a field.
And if he was renting fields, did you often have to move the animals from field?
Yeah, they got moved around a bit. Yeah, there was one or two they were off in it. Yeah, there was all of that sort of stuff that went on. But we were in the countryside and we had like so much freedom. And we would just go off on our bikes and go and like make dams, me and my sisters, in the streams. We had a lot of freedom. We'd go and build dens in haystacks in the local farmer's place. It was great. And then we started working quite young. I remember I had a Saturday job with one of your columnists who lived locally, Prue Leith. My elder sister had the Saturday job first, and then it got kind of passed down to my middle sister, and then me, the youngest. And we got progressively worse at the job as we went down. My elder sister was brilliant, super efficient, and Prue loved her. Middle sister, yeah, she's kind of okay, and I was completely hopeless. And I think I got fired, which
what
I've always
was
been
the
a
job?
Bit, it was just, I don't know, what we were just helping her out. And we used to make her husband coffee at exactly 10 a.m., and then we would help wash up, help cook, but I knew nothing about cooking. I knew nothing about any of the ingredients. She'd tell me to go off and pick some mint or coriander from the garden. And then I'd just go into, and I was so scared of her. I'd be completely paralyzed by fear, thinking, shall I just go and pick some random green stuff? Or shall I risk using her phone, which I wasn't allowed to do, and ring my mum and get my mum to describe it to me down the phone, which is what I would invariably do. We were just, yeah, all kinds of things like that. It was quite an education in a way, actually. She was great. She was very firm, but quite fair. She was fair, only she fired me for something that I didn't do, and I'm still bitter about it to this day, and I'd love her to know that. Maybe I'll see her at one of your parties and I'll be able to tell
her. She might listen to this podcast.
If you're listening, she took me...
She has been on, so...
I know, I heard her one, actually. She was one of my... I listened to her before coming in. Well, she took me off into a room and said she needed to speak to me, and she said that these bunch of flowers that I was supposed to put in a vase of water the day before, which I did, and put on a table in her sitting room, apparently she'd found the vase empty and water all over one of her favourite sofas. So she was convinced that I'd somehow managed to empty the vase out onto the sofa before putting it back onto the table to pretend I hadn't done it. I protested and protested, but the more I protested, the more she was convinced that I wasn't just crap, but I was a liar as well. And then she never asked me back after that. But someone else did it. It wasn't me.
If you know who that person was,
I tried blaming it on the dog, which was a bit ridiculous because the dog couldn't have done that. But someone did it.
Dog could have knocked it over, though.
Yeah, but they wouldn't have righted it again. That was her point. At that point, I just kind of fell silent because I knew she didn't believe me.
She does have a son who's now a Tory MP.
I remember him. He used to come in and get Coca-Cola from the fridge.
Maybe he's one to look at Danny Creed.
I'll go through him.
Now, was he responsible?
Actually, a friend of mine went out with her nephew, Sam, who works here at once, and I'm sure I cornered him drunk in a party and ranted about it.
This will have a resolution. Now, growing up, were you artistic? How was school? Were you academic?
I was more artistic, but I was quite academic. I hesitate because I was always told I wasn't academic at school, but actually I was, I think. More so than they... I went to a very academic school, so out of the people at the school, I was probably one of the least because they all seemed to go off and become doctors and lawyers. And I definitely just wanted to be in the art room all the time, but that wasn't really encouraged. But then I did well. I got good grades, but only... No, I wasn't that academic. I don't know. I think I'm really good at learning how to pass a test. That's what I did. But I wasn't that engaged with academia, no. I was much more into drama and art. None of those things were particularly nurtured at my school, I don't think. So I would just kind of, whenever I was at home, I would be messing around making stuff.
You went on to study English literature at university, so why did you pick that topic?
I think I just wanted to...
I know lots of people who just pick it.
Exactly. It was one of those. I wanted to come to London. I had a boyfriend who lived in London at 16, and I had decided that I just wanted to live in London, so I only applied to London universities. I hadn't done art A-level, which was a bit stupid of me. I went through a strange phase. I say strange because I just can't fathom it now because I would hate to act, but I wanted to be an actress briefly as a teenager. And so I did theatre studies for A-level instead of art, which meant I couldn't then apply for art college, which was a mistake, I guess. But, you know, I found a weird circuitous route to art anyway. And I just was okay. I was quite good at English. I seemed to do quite well in English literature, so it seemed like the obvious thing to do. But it kind of killed all interest in literature going to university because I was expected to read 4 books a week and I couldn't even read 1 a week. So I just sort of stopped reading around then, I think.
You said previously you didn't particularly enjoy your university experience. Why was that?
Well, firstly, because I thought I was coming to London and I was actually in halls of residence in South Woodford, which was basically Essex. And yeah. I remember, that was massive, crushing disappointment. We were just driving through South Woodford and looking for the halls of residence, my mum and I. And I was getting more and more angry about the fact that she was about to drop me off here. And I was saying, this is not what I want. And then I saw this I saw the most kind of derelict, crappy looking tower block overlooking the A12. And I pointed at that and I said, it's probably going to be there. And she said, oh, don't be ridiculous. Of course it won't be there. You know, I'm sure it'll be lovely. And we drove around in circles trying to find it. And then, of course, that was exactly where it was. And I was like on the 12th floor overlooking the A12. It was like a little cell. It was horrible. And I would think I was quite mature at that age. I'd already been coming up to London and going to parties and having fun a bit. And I've got older sisters, so I had older friends. And I just remember the first night, them all crushing into this student bar downstairs and getting completely wasted and shagging each other, and it didn't quite time with what I wanted to do, I don't think.
Didn't sing the university experience, yeah, perhaps, and coming
then,
of age.
And I was shy. I was really shy. I think that was the other thing. I was kind of... I was shy around people who I didn't instantly feel any kind of connection to, and I found it... It was already quite cliquey. I think a lot of the people there were from London, and maybe they all knew each other already. Then I was never one of those people who would volunteer. I would sit, I would have all kinds of thoughts sitting in the lectures, but I would never stick my hand up and say anything. So I kind of got lost a bit there. I just didn't make any friends. And then I got a job at this bar that you mentioned, and I made all my friends there, and I had a completely separate life there. And that was like my university, really.
And that was in Shoreditch, which I imagine was more the type of London you were expecting when you headed to the capital.
No, actually, not then. No, it was. I remember going there. Someone I'd heard it was going to be this cool place at some point, and I had already been there a few times because my boyfriend lived in Stoke Newington and he had friends down there. But I'd heard that the bar there that I ended up working in served absinthe because it was quite new to serve absinthe at that time, and there was very few places selling it. So I arranged with I made one friend briefly at university, and I arranged with her to go and drink absinthe there. And we got there and there was absolutely nothing in the area. Everything just looked completely just unused and a bit derelict. And apart from this one bar, and it was completely empty. And there was like absolutely no kind of vibe at all. And we sat on a little table by the window. And I went to the bar and there was a
bringing our producer at this point.
Barman. Who happens to now be your podcast editor? I don't know if I should
ask
say
that. Ask, do you want to get on the mic and say hi?
And I asked the barman, who looked really sullen and bored, if there was any jobs going.
Is this you?
Yes.
Great. Our handsome podcast producer back then, yes. He said he gave you a job.
No, he didn't. He said there were none going. But then someone didn't turn up that night collecting glasses, and I got a call from the manager asking me to come in and do that. So I started as a glass collector, and it was busier in the evenings. And then Shoreditch did start to kind of happen around that time, but it was really, it wasn't much at the time, no. But it definitely felt like the people there were my kind of people. I felt instantly much, I just got on with the people working there, the people drinking there. It was great. And I ended up staying in that bar throughout, because I needed financial help to pay through university because I didn't have any family money. And then so I kind of used to ended up working like 4 or 5 shifts a week, I think, through university. And then when I graduated, and I, you know, just had no idea what I was going to do, they offered me the position of manager. So I ended up managing it for a few years afterwards.
And during that time, because I suppose we're trying to explain how you got from there to your current work as an artist, did you meet many artistic types? Did anything there kind of lead you to taxidermy?
Yeah, it's difficult to plot the exact trajectory, but yes, I met loads of artistic types. I mean, it was the bar where all the so-called YBAs were drinking, so they were all, I was very familiar with all of them. I became friendly with some of them. The White Cube Gallery was around the corner, and other galleries were popping up, and we were always kind of off to get free beer at private views and things. The people who worked behind the bar, they pretty much all were like art or fashion students or graduates. And I think it was just more that I started to realise that despite doing English literature, I wasn't really that interested. I did an internship at The Independent, and I did like some kind of journalism course. And I just didn't feel, I remember at the journalism course, it was this 3-month thing they did at LCP. And at the end, they went round through the class, and it was like 12 or 14 of us or something. And they said, asked everyone to announce what they'd learned from the course. And I just said, I'd learned that I didn't really want to be a journalist. It was good. It was useful for that. Quite well, actually. No, I think weirdly enough, the tutor I ended up going on a bender with a few months later, because he came into the showrooms and he said that I'd probably made the right decision, I think he said. No, it just occurred to me that I was just much more artistic than, and I should have been doing something like that. I probably should have gone to art college, but didn't. So I just sort of had to find my own way. I did a photography course. I was always like messing around with, I'd go like on my days off, I'd just go and buy a bag of clay and like mess around. I didn't really have any direction though. I didn't know what to do with any of those things. And I also was surrounded by lots of people who were already doing very well at painting or photography or a lot of these more popular mediums, and I just didn't really see how I could bring anything to that. And then it was almost like I had a mental checklist of things to learn, and then taxidermy came up because I just wanted to buy some taxidermy for my flat that I was living in. I eventually got given a flat above the I went from glass collector to manager with a flat above the shop for a bit. So I went from having a tiny box room in a shared house to suddenly having my own flat, and I had absolutely nothing to put in it. Started trying to buy some taxidermy online, looking for stuff online, but I couldn't find anything that I wanted. And I realised that I wanted it to look dead. Not because I'm morbid, like as lots of people have written, but because I think I just find taxidermy more effective when the animal looks dead, because you know almost instantly if you look at a taxidermy bird that's mid-flight or that's perched on a twig inside, you know it's dead, because it wouldn't be perched on a twig or mid-flight inside. It's like, you know, there's a frozen moment. If it looks dead, it's much more, you can kind of extend that trick, I guess. Anyway, that is a very, very wordy response to your question, but I finally hit on taxidermy. I realised there weren't people really making it in the way that I wanted it displayed. So I decided to do it myself, and I went and found someone who could give me a lesson.
Yeah, I've got in my notes you took a one-day course.
Yeah. Is it? Well, there wasn't really anything. There was a three-day course, but I couldn't really take that. Three- and five-day course. But they were quite expensive, and I couldn't take that kind of time off work so easily. And I'm not really a team player. I learn a lot better when it's one-to-one. So I didn't want to be in a group of people learning. I wanted to have one-to-one tuition, and I found a guy who offered lessons in Scotland, and a friend of mine lived in Edinburgh, so I decided to stay with her and then go and do this incredibly rushed pigeon. And we did it. We managed to do it in a day, and I jumped back on the train back to London with it. But I was really excited. I really felt like I'd kind of hit on something that I could explore. I'm competitive, and I think the thing is I didn't know anyone doing taxidermy, so I had no competition. That made it a kind of easy way to learn, in a way.
So you've got your pigeon, and that goes in your flat, but at that point, it's no longer just about decorating your flat. You're thinking it's something you want to pursue. And how do you start, I suppose, deciding what more you're going to do, picking which animals?
Well, yeah, I didn't have a plan. I certainly didn't think it was going to become a career or like I would make money from it, really. I thought maybe I could supplement my income somehow if I got good at it by doing it. But I didn't really expect anyone to like the stuff that I was making, because I was making it for me, really. And I didn't think necessarily my taste would chime with other people. But then I had to hang around for weeks trying to get hold of a dead bird, because I decided I didn't want anything killed. I mean, mostly it's illegal to kill stuff for taxidermy anyway, but you could get some game birds and stuff. Anyway, finally someone found a branch-legged partridge and sent me, and then I did that on my kitchen table and would send pictures up to George, the guy in Edinburgh who taught me. And then I had this sort of long-distance tuition, I guess, where I'd go and see him occasionally when I got the chance. And we became friends, and he just said that I could come and work alongside him in his workshops for free if I could get up to Edinburgh. So I would do that every now and then. But I just had all these ideas suddenly. As soon as I think every time, and I get this every time in my art. I mean, by the way, I call myself an artist, not a taxidermist, because I'm not really, I don't have the same concerns as a taxidermist at all. Their interest is in mimicking wildlife, really, and that's not really what I do. I always take them out of context and do something weird with them. And even now, I'm not even actually using the actual skins of snakes right now. I'm casting and painting them. But every time I learn a new technique, so I've learned molding and casting and now painting, it just opens up. It's sort of like I've kind of crowbarred open a door somewhere, and like I suddenly get flooded with all these ideas. So I think I then just started making stuff. It was really just a question of being in the right place at the right time as well, because I think it was it was being in the right place at the right time, but also I feel like I gravitated to that place because I was sort of the right person for that place at that time, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, that makes sense. I suppose for our listeners who are not completely well-versed in the world of taxidermy and also an artistic approach to that, can you just talk us through the basic steps? So step one, you have to locate a dead animal, already mm-hmm. dead, and then does it have to, can that be, so this is a very stupid question, but can that be roadkill?
Yeah.
Or does it, what's the kind of go-to route if you're trying to find animal carcasses?
You just have to be imaginative and just speak to people who work with them, really. I mean, it's kind of lazy to kill anything anyway, because they're always dying. I've always, depending on what it was I wanted to work with, when I was working with birds, I would speak to everyone I knew in the country, particularly people with cats, because cats bring things in. People with large windows would give me things quite a lot, because birds were always flying into them and breaking their necks. So yeah, find someone with a very modern house. then I would speak to breeders. I mean, the main thing is to get to speak to breeders, because there's always deaths when you're breeding animals. So snakes now, I get them all from snake breeders or snake rescue centres.
And then from there, I suppose it depends a lot depending on the animal, but how long would it then take from getting that to having a piece produced?
Oh, it depends a lot on... Well, if you were just doing straightforward taxidermy, which I don't do, if you were just doing... Starting from...
But for you.
But yeah, if you just started... If you wanted to just taxidermy a bird or taxidermy a snake, then it's a question of getting the animal, putting it in your freezer, unless you plan to start on it immediately, which most people don't. So you freeze it. Once you've frozen it, it's fine until you're ready to work on it. You thaw it out when you're ready to work on it, and then you skin it. So you normally make an incision along the breast and just sort of peel the skin off the whole thing. You skin things different ways depending on whether they're bird or mammal or reptile. And then you have to clean up the skin. You don't want any flesh or fat on the skin when you've finished. You tan the skin. Again, there's different ways of tanning different skins. And then you build an armature, like a body, a sculpture, but to go inside. So you can have, so you might find like a squashed fox on the road. And then by the time you've skinned it, cleaned up the skin and washed it and dried it, it's looking beautiful again. Maybe it was a bit cut. You can stitch up any holes in it. And then if you want it lying on its back in a sort of playful pose, you could have that, or you could have it running, whatever. It's just the body that you build that dictates the position it's in afterwards. And then you stretch the skin over the top and stitch up.
And then for you at that point, you're working at how you want to present it, because it is not just straightforward taxidermy.
Yeah, but well, because I work with lots of other materials too, so it's not just that. I'm normally casting something for it to go alongside or something. So my sculptures take a lot longer. Well, they don't all take a lot longer. Some of them are quite short if they're quite small and not that complicated. Others can take months.
And how did it start becoming a professional thing for you? Because you mentioned how you thought maybe it'd be side earnings, but did people see them in your... see ones you had done and start wanting to buy them, and did it go from there?
Yeah, well, what happened was there was... One of the co-managers at the electricity showrooms went off and opened a bar and restaurant called Bistro Tech in East London. And he had they had a deal with PlayStation, I believe it was, and they'd given them some glass domes PlayStation. They looked just like normal Victorian glass domes, but they had a small logo somewhere on them. And he wanted to have some kind of artworks or something to go inside them. And he knew that I was learning taxidermy, and he said, how about you put some taxidermy things in here? So I decided, rather than just putting a straightforward piece of taxidermy, I'd kind of make these little scenes. And I did that, and that was really good. It was great that he asked me to do that, because I'm not good at finishing stuff unless I have a deadline. I mean, like most people, I guess, but I was just sort of starting bits of taxidermy and just kind of leaving them lying around, when really you need to fix them down and really kind of work and paint them and make them perfect. And it was only when he asked me to do that I was forced to actually make four complete little works. And then he suggested we had a little kind of unveiling party, which we did. And it was just that I knew that so many of my friends were either working in or involved in art, that the people who came, and then also people used to drink and still do drink at Bistro Tech, they're all very creative types. So it felt like an art opening, and it hadn't meant to be. And there was press there. And I remember some topless woman interviewing me for a show called Naked News. It was all very weird and overwhelming and not at all what I'd expected, but quite funny. And then someone came up and started asking me loads of questions about the works and how much they were and how long it takes me to do them and whether I can produce more. And then as he left, someone else came up and said, did you know that was Banksy? Which I didn't know. Oh, and then after that, a friend of mine had a little... he was an artist, but he also had a gallery, and he had a stand at the Zoo Art Fair, which was used to run the same time as Frieze Art Fair, but for younger galleries. And he wanted me to put some work in there, and I put something in there, and it sold before the fair even opened. And then when I was at the fair, I bumped into Banksy again, and he asked me to do something for something that he was setting up. From that moment on, for quite some time, I just always had something else on the horizon. Like someone would commission me, or someone would ask me to put something in a show. And I just about managed to eke a living. I mean, it was a tiny living, and I was living in effectively a shed on an industrial estate in Hackney Wick, where the Olympic Park is now built. So my expenses were pretty low. It's not very, you know, I'm working with dead animals. The materials aren't that expensive. I just about managed to keep going. And then, and I just kind of rolled with it.
How did you decide the price for a piece of artwork, particularly when you're starting out? Because, I mean, you could pretty much well, say with anything. A bit, I mean, you never quite know. And I'm quite hesitant, even in like salary negotiations. I'm like,
yeah.
Do you want to say two? But I wonder, how do you go about it? Especially well, luckily, in the early days.
Yeah, well, I mean, because it was a zoo art fair, it was for younger galleries and none of the work was super expensive or it shouldn't have been in there really. The whole point was it's kind of more affordable. But yeah, I had the advice of the guy who was running the stand and my boyfriend at the time, who was an artist, and they both encouraged me to put it higher than I think it was £2,200 or something, the first work that I sold. And I thought that was just like a staggering amount of money. But that kind of set the price at that point. Once that sold, then everything sort of was around that mark or $3,000-$4,000. And a gallery takes 50% anyway, and then your expenses come off and you're not actually making a fortune, particularly as you're not then going to probably sell something for another few months.
You just do your tax return.
Exactly. You give it all away.
What did your friends and family think when you started doing more of this? Were any of them surprised? Or
surprised, yeah. But I think my mum was just so relieved. I think she had always thought I just remember she always used to say, oh, what are we going to do with you? She would just say it regularly to me. Like, she had a lot of faith in me. I think she thought I was smart, but she just, I was sort of lacking focus, I guess. I mean, I was only, looking back on it now, I was only 23 or 4 when I started to learn taxidermy, so it's not that bad. But at the time, it felt quite stressful, like I needed to get a job. My sisters had settled down to quite steady jobs quite early on, and I sort of wasn't showing any signs of doing that, and I didn't really want to do it. And I think she was just worried that she just had no idea where I was going to end up. So she was really relieved. I think she was proud and very, very relieved that it was actually proving to be something viable.
And you start having quite a glamorous lifestyle at this point. There's in Kutch, you know, talk of being invited to, you know, mansions and yachts of millionaires.
Like, where did you read that?
It was in my notes. Mentioned.
Well, everyone in the yacht world does actually at some point. Maybe
did you get to go in a yacht? Have you got to go in a yacht?
I have got to go in yachts. Yeah, it's true. Well, because people who buy art are rich and they like being around artists, because other rich people are quite boring, I guess. You know, a lot of the time, I think when you're a billionaire, well, to each other, I think a lot of billionaires or even millionaires, I guess they all just hang out with each other, because if you're going to be complaining about the staff, you can't really do that around someone who's got no money or who is staff. So I think you just end up being a little bit isolated in your wealth, and actually they want to have a more kind of diverse group of friends. And by buying art and hanging out with artists, it's access to quite a different world, which they enjoy. And likewise, we quite enjoy it because we're mostly broke and we get given food and drink. I think that's all changing a lot now, though, that the art world is very different to the art world now to the one that I entered back then. We were all quite feckless and irresponsible, and we'd take any invite and jump on any plane and any yacht. But the artists these days are a lot more socially conscious.
And as you were coming up, how did you find, I suppose, the media reception to your works? Because I mentioned in the introduction, you know, those, you know, question what you're doing. Have people been very critical?
No, not really. People have been really nice. I mean, I've heard people slag my work off in galleries, but it's quite funny. I've been standing next to my work or near it and someone's come in and looked at it and they obviously don't know I made it, and they've said, oh, this is pathetic.
Do you introduce yourself at that point?
That'd be quite, I should have done, shouldn't I? But no, I've had really good, I was always really surprised. I've had really nice press. To start with, it was all based on like, oh, look, she's young and pretty and blonde and she stuffs animals, and it was obviously just all about that. But I was happy to take anything that was on offer, really. I mean, if that was what got me noticed, fine. But then I did start to realise, no, I'm slightly joking there, because I had a few things. I started to realise that actually the interest, I was getting more interest in fashion magazines and art magazines, which was not unwelcome. But at the same time, I was slightly worried that people weren't going to take me seriously as an artist, because I was quite serious and I am quite serious about what I do. So I think with age and, like, you know, looks slipping away, that probably helps. Now the focus is much more on my art than it is on me, and that's very good. But people say nice things generally. I mean, there's definitely bad stuff out there. Occasionally I've got a bit drunk and looked on the online and found blogs and things where people are being rude about me. But that was years ago, and I don't do that kind of thing anymore. I'm too busy.
Never search your name, I think, is a good rule in life for anyone.
The first time I did that was before I was making anything. I remember before I did taxidermy or anything, and I had a friend who was like, I can't remember, they were a writer or something, and Googled them and loads of stuff came up and it looked really good. Early days of the internet. I remember Googling myself and hitting enter, and the first image that came up was a gravestone with my name on it. And that was about it.
Now, you mentioned your latest exhibition on your work on snakes. Can you talk us through it? Was that a lockdown project or was that kind of thought of before? Has lockdown shaped what you've been doing?
Yeah, lockdown did shape it, but it was planned before lockdown and the pandemic was before we'd even heard of COVID. I'd made a plan to have a show, but then all of that happened and that was actually the period in which I made it, and it did shape the work quite significantly, I think. And I was really lucky. I managed to get it made, like just to get a show on, because it was really, I've got a 4-year-old and a 2.5-year-old. And they were just at home all the time, and it's so difficult to get any work done with them there. But actually, my boyfriend's an artist too, and he was home a lot more than he had been because he'd been travelling so much before. So we kind of just like tag-teamed the kids. And the good thing is we live and work in the same place. So suddenly that really came into its own, and I would race down to the basement and work in my workshop. And then I'd run up and take over the kids, and he'd run down and do some work. And the amazing thing is the show was like penciled in for October, which was just after things started opening up, and there wasn't the Frieze Art Fair had been cancelled, so there was quite a lot of shows on, but nothing like as many as there probably would have been. And I think people were really keen to get out and see stuff, so I was worried about doing it. I thought maybe it was a bit pointless, it was just a bad year to show work, and then it actually worked out really well because the footfall was great and I had some really good reviews, and I was just, yeah, I was really happy that I felt very lucky that I even got to put it on because most things were cancelled.
Now, I just got final 3 quick questions.
Okay.
And the first is, I suppose, looking back, is there a particular piece that is the most memorable for you?
No. Well...
Or is there one that you haven't wanted to sell?
That started happening to me. I never used to feel that way about it. I was always desperate to get rid of it. And I think my work's got better, which is good, because I actually quite like hanging on to things now. And there was one I sold from my last show that I found really painful, but luckily it sold to a woman who I really like. And I sort of felt, and she said, you can come and see it whenever you want. So I'm quite happy about that. The thing is, if you don't get rid of stuff, it sort of occupies your space and your mind. And I think you do need to just, it's like having kids. You just got to let them go and just kind of move on to the next project.
What's in your freezer now? Have you got any, other than your fish fingers or peas?
Yeah, well, that. And then also quite a lot of chopped up snakes, some whole snakes, some skin snakes, a cat. Giant rabbit, one of those giant indoor pet ones, which has been there for about 12, 14 years since my friend's dog killed her pet rabbit. And then just loads of other little birds and mice and just everything. I get given so many things. I've started turning stuff down now because I'm not working with birds and mammals as much. But
you must have a really big freezer.
Oh, I've got several freezers, yeah. I used to have 5, but I'm down to 2 now. I'm trying to slim down a bit.
And have you got a separate food freezer?
I do now, yeah. I mean, things sneak down and up sometimes. The one upstairs, the kitchen freezer's currently got a couple of birds in, I think, that someone's given me. But yeah, there's quite a good
separation.
I would
worry after a few drinks.
Yeah. I'm getting really hungry.
Now, the final thing I wanted to ask, which is the question we ask everyone on this podcast, which is, I mean, we're talking about your career and it sounds so broadly it's been a very positive experience. But so this might go back to uni or school, but, you know, what is the worst advice you've ever been given, whether or not you decided to take it?
Well, it would have been given to me by my mother, sorry, if you're listening. And she told me to marry a rich man. And marry a rich man and you know, settle down. Or just marry a rich man and then you won't have to worry about work. I'm very happy I didn't do that. I think there's so much stuff that I have achieved has come about because I haven't had money. I've had wealthy friends and I've looked at them and it sounds ridiculous in this age where we think about privilege all the time, but I feel really sorry for some of the friends who grew up with lots of money because that motivation that I had is just totally lacking and they don't. And also if you grow up with parents who've been wildly, wildly successful at something or other, you've got such a high standard to live up to. And I just, yeah. And the other, anyway, that's the growing up with money thing, but marrying money too. It's not my money, it doesn't count. It's only ever counted for me when I've earned my own money, and it's really given me such a buzz to be completely self-sufficient. And I bought myself a flat when I was about 30, and it was like my kind of proudest achievement because I did it without any help at all. And all of those things, they just contribute to my overall happiness, I think.
Thank you, Polly. Thanks for listening. And if you'd like to send us your feedback on this podcast or any other many podcasts, please do get in touch. Just email us at podcast@spectator.co.uk.